Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is The Key for Finding and Keeping Love with Jenna LaFlamme. So I would like to welcome any new members who are here and for our audience listening at home tonight and also our audience here. So we will be having questions at about 6:45. We will be having a handheld mic that will pass around. This program is being recorded for a potential airplay later on, but it will be podcast on the Commonwealth Club website. So please don't just shout out your questions. Make sure that the questions go into the microphone so that they will go onto the podcast for our listeners at home. I'll tell you a little bit about Jenna, and this is a special Valentine's Day program, so I'm happy that we could do this tonight. Jenna LaFlamme is a weight loss coach for women and men, the creator of pleasurable weight loss, and the founder of the Jenna Wellness Center in New York City. She teaches men and women how to fit into their favorite clothes and feel fit and fabulous without dieting, deprivation, or giving up chocolate. Sounds good for Valentine's Day, huh? And you can find, you can get access to more about Jenna at pleasurableweightlessness.com. So with that, I'd like to introduce Jenna LaFlamme.
Though I thought I wouldn't be included within the halls of love, I of course still wanted it. I still wanted a partner. I want it, but I probably can't have it. So not even really wanting to admit to myself that I wanted it, but I wanted it. So I'm with him in Israel, and we're catching up. How's life? What's going on? Who have you been dating? And I tell him my stories, and he goes, Jenna, I've got some feedback for you. From what you're saying, I get the impression that you think that love is limitation. I let that sink in, and I thought, yeah, you're right. I do think that love is limitation. I think love is going to clip my wings. I'm going to be put in a box, and, you know, I'd rather not. And he said to me, but no. You've got it wrong. That's not what love is at all. So I'm here tonight to take you on the same journey, to bring to the surface any misunderstandings you might have about love and show you the keys for finding it and for keeping it. So let's begin there. What might be the fears about love? Mine was entrapment and being caged. Everyone has their different ones. What other flavors of fears about love are there?
Not deserving.
Uh-huh. Not deserving.
Vulnerability.
Lovability?
Vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Will it have a good ending? Will it have a bad ending?
Yeah.
Okay. Painful ending. Okay. Mother-in-law. So, commitment, yes. So we have not deserving, vulnerability, bad ending, entrapment, responsibility, commitment. And yet we still have our hopes, too, right? So what are the hopes?
That have been life-changing.
Life-changing.
Bliss.
Life-changing, bliss, satisfaction. Mutual feeling, good sex.
Pleasurable company.
Companionship. Okay, my page is full. So despite all the hopes, all the fears, we still have hopes. And I'm here today in this time I have with you to take your fears and show them that you can bring these hopes alive. Now, who am I? I am Jenna LaFlamme, and by day, I'm a weight loss expert for women. I teach them how to lose weight by adding more pleasure to their lives. But today's Valentine's Day, and we won't be talking about that. We're going to be talking about love. And a lot of the skills and the conversations that I have with women, and these techniques, they do apply to men too, to help them lose weight, the conversation is around their relationship with their body, as I like to call it, their relationship with their animal, because your body's an animal. And this conversation about love is not that different, because in a relationship of two people, you know, you're relating with their animal, and they're relating with yours. So that's where we're going to begin, which is redefining, you know, who we are in a relationship anyway. What I've discovered, the most useful and fruitful way to enter a relationship, you know, to attract it and to keep it, is to shift your understanding of yourself from there being one of you, this voice, the me, I, one, probably know pretty well, to understanding that there's two of you. There's this one, and there's this one. There's the intelligence in your mind, and there's the intelligence in your body. The conscious mind, well, it gets a lot of attention and free rein in our society, a lot of respect. We really respect the mind a lot and give it a lot of freedom. But the body, we learn from a pretty young age, is supposed to look a certain way, not the other way. And we all attract at a very young age, it's epidemic in our society, this idea that our body's not good. Can you relate with that? And less so than we get the idea that our mind is not good. And we have a society that's skewed to putting a lot more value on this part up here than this part down here. So today we're going to learn a bit more about how to rearrange that relationship with your body. And I call this relationship your primary relationship. This is your primary relationship right here. And the quality of this relationship is going to define the quality of the relationship with the other. Simple. So how do you get a good relationship with your body? Well, the first thing to do is to meet her or meet him. So right now, I would like you to uncross your legs and put your hand on your belly and your rib cage and to meet your animal, meet your body. Take a deep breath and you'll feel the life within. Ah, there it is. The one life you've been given, your body. Now, love can eventually lead to marriage and can lead to divorce. And I'm divorced and remarried. Very, very happily. But there's a marriage that's more, even more intimate than the one with the other, and this is this marriage of body and mind. And from this one, there ain't no divorce possible. It's truly until death do us part. Because if he dies, if you're a man, if he dies, you die. If you're a woman, if she dies, you're a goner. You really do depend on her. You know, we say in love, like, I need you, I can't live without you. It's actually not true, but with this one, it's true. You need her. You need him. And in our society, we refer to the body as it. That's the correct way to say it. Your body, it. Let's throw grammar out the window and give what I call the proper naming to your body, your animal, which is she, if you're a woman, or he, if you're a man. So digest that for a moment. How does that feel to think of your body as he, as she, as you feel the breath coming in and out, as you experience that there is a living, breathing, decision-making creature right there? A great metaphor is your mind as the rider and your body as the horse. In the combination of a horse and rider, the rider's on top holding the reins, clearly in control. Well, having the illusion of control, because we actually know the horse is way stronger and could throw off that rider and in any second it chose. Yet, the ideal is the rider and the horse going through life together as one. And that's the opportunity you have. That's the situation you have, actually, whether you like it or not, is your mind and body in this relationship where the reins held by the rider, held by the mind, can either be held too tightly. You know that feeling like, oh, not enough time, I'm too busy, I can't, too busy to eat, too busy to... What does that feel like when your reins are too tight in your life? Stressful?
Anxious?
Rushed? Deadlines? Modern day, we know about reins too tight. It's pretty familiar. And then the other extreme is reins too loose. Your horse can just go anywhere, eat anything, sleep in. No, screw exercise. Horse out of control. And that's my background for years, and how I became a weight loss coach is that I struggled with emotional eating. And that horse was just let loose. I wasn't responsible riding. And so what we're looking for is to have the reins not too tight, but not too loose with your horse just right. So to get you in touch with your horse, I'm actually going to take you on a little journey with some music so you can feel your body. So what I'm going to have you do is sit in the front of your chair and hold on to your knees like this. And you're going to arch your back as you inhale. And you're going to curl your back as you exhale. And that's it. Keep going. Inhale. And exhale. That's it. Inhaling and exhaling. We're now connecting you with the living part of you, your horse. Breathing together. The mind is the rider. The body is the horse. Imagine yourselves riding across the field, across a prairie, riding comfortably. Hands are on the front of your knees, you're arching your back, you're curling, and you're breathing. That's it. Now, the objective here is to get into harmony with the body, by feeling, by sensing. Your body speaks through the language of sensations, of feeling, not of words. So here, using your breath, feeling your body as you move with your horse. And we're going to breathe together with the rhythm, breathing in and breathing out, breathing in. And breathing out, and breathing in, and breathing out. That's it. Moving with your horse. Inhale, exhale. Inhale, exhale. Feel the power of your body. That's it. Feel your spine, feel the strong legs of your horse as you're moving across the land. Inhaling and exhaling. Faster, imagining that you are taking your horse up a hill. There's a hill ahead, and you're going to find the power in your body, and you're going to move. Inhale, exhale. Inhale, exhale. Inhale, exhale. Inhale, exhale. That's it. Riding up that hill, feeling the aliveness of your body. Breathing. And now you arrive at the top. Slow down on your horse, come to water, okay, come off your horse, come onto the ground, the horse reaches into the water and drinks, you rest, you feel each other together. Horse and rider as one. You can open your eyes, come back, and you have met him. You have met her. Did anyone hear anything from their horse? Any information come from your body while breathing with your spine moving and feeling your energy? Let's go. Let's go? Oh, great. Who else? Messages from the body?
I have more energy than you think I do.
I have more energy than you think I do.
Enjoy freedom.
Okay. I'm strong. I want an apple. Excellent. So, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Flow. Okay. So there, we just spent 2 minutes less trying to connect with your body. In an exercise, in a group of people, in a room, music, trying to listen, trying to forge a connection there. And that's what we want in your primary relationship, is for you to understand the needs of your body and how to have a great relationship there. A lot of us walk around with an abusive relationship with our body. We're really mean to our body. Have you noticed that? A lot of people are cruel to their body. They're critical. They say bad things to their body that they wouldn't say to someone they love. And they feel shame about their body. It's like feeling shame about your mother. Ouch. Doesn't feel good. Your mother's the one that gave you life, and your body's the one that allows you life every day. So investing in this primary relationship and feeling at peace with the fact that your body is an animal and has animal appetites, which we're about to talk about, is the number one key. So now we go into relationship, and we find that there's not two, but there's four in the relationship. Because there's my mind and my animal, and his mind and his animal, or her, as the case may be. So can you imagine? That's double trouble. Two horses in the house? Oh, no. That's a lot of hay we need. So now you have the mind of one relating with the mind of the other, the animal of one relating with the animal of the other, and then the mind of one relating with the animal of the other, and the mind of this one relating with the animal of that one. You see that? That's why love's so complicated. It's not just a matter of your rational selves getting along. There's the mystery of the heart. And then there's this whole realm of your bodies being animals. In a culture where the mind is supposedly superior to the body, to the animal, and it's starting with a need for some affirmative action, clearly. So that's what we're doing today. It's giving some affirmative action and paying attention to what are the needs of the body. So what are the needs of the body? Food, water, air, touch, sleep, exercise, movement. Got that? Sex, yeah. Hoping that would come up. And sleep we've got. Excellent. So these are just a few basic needs of the body, not that many. You know, he, your animal, she, your animal, doesn't ask for much at all. It gives you everything all day long. But one thing we notice is that all animals, all creatures, orient towards pleasure. Pleasure, here we have pleasure. Whoops. And pain. And going way back in time to the time we were single-cell creatures, we were amoebas. Little amoeba wriggles through space, bumps into something painful, and goes, ooh, death, threat of death, danger, get away. And there's this repulsive energy that's actually quite random, that's just get away energy. And then when it bumps into pleasure, it goes, ooh, life-affirming, safety, good, yeah, I'm going this way. And that's how we've evolved with that basic filter away from pain towards pleasure from the time we were amoebas to now. We're really fancy amoebas, aren't we? So what we find is this conflict of interest because the body is seeking pleasure. Have you noticed that? Your body is a pleasure-seeking creature? But what does the mind think of pleasure? Let's give a dump on pleasure from the mind. Oh, disruptive. Destructive. Wasteful.
Distraction.
Yeah, disruptive. Distraction. Judgment, greedy. Oh, yeah, definitely. Superficial. Mm-hmm. Selfish, yeah, greedy. I can spell here. Fish show. Okay. You see, that conflict of interest is really deep, where we have the body going, yay, pleasure, love it.
Mind, pleasure, that's really greedy, selfish, destructive, distractive, disruptive.
So what do we do about that? So we need to investigate and see what the heck is going on. So in my investigation, what I've discovered is it wasn't always this way. There was a time when pleasure was regarded sacred. Pleasure, because when you're in rapture with pleasure, you're in rapture with the senses, that was seen as an honoring of the source of life, the source of your ability to experience and sense itself. By being involved in that, by being focused and attending to the aliveness of pleasure, of whatever it is, sensing, that was considered an honoring and a prayer. So could you imagine growing up in a way where all sexual pleasure was seen like a prayer and an honoring to God, versus how we get it now, the messages about how sacred sex is or not? Other examples, just a client was telling me the other day, when she was 3 years old, she was supposedly folding laundry. And her way of folding laundry was jumping around with the towels and the sheets. And Dad came along and Dad said, "You're not, that's not efficient. You can't fold the laundry like that." And she got in trouble for that. And, she really respected Dad. And the whole world seemed to conform with what Dad thought. And she learned from a young age that pleasure, no value in that. And again, we get these messages that our seeking of pleasure is meaningless, whereas in times gone by, we were told that pleasure was the most sacred thing. So how could pleasure be the most sacred thing? Well, there's a few ways that pleasure intersects with the sacred. And one is the maxim you've heard before, which is about being present. And being present is the key of all religions and sacred practices. And that is one of the secrets of pleasure, is that you have to be present to experience it. And I want to distinguish between pleasure and addiction, because I think some of this actually is addiction, or what I would call this, counterfeit pleasure. Actually, where's my other pen? Okay.
So there are so many other pleasures. There's such a wide spectrum of pleasures.
Okay, so there's a wide spectrum of pleasures, and these are what I'm going to call counterfeit pleasure. And what true pleasure I distinguish with what I call the true pleasure filter question, which is this giving me pleasure now? Will it in a day? Will it in an hour? Will it in a day? Will it in a week? Will it in a month? And if you can contact your future self And imagine a year from now, is he looking back going, yeah, great move, pleasure. Still pleasuring me out here. Or will there be this pang of regret, of shame? That's often one way that we know. A quote by a famous relationship with food expert, Janine Roth. She says, it's when pleasure ends that overeating begins. It's when pleasure ends that overeating begins. When pleasure has its own built-in control mechanisms in a way. And it's not even necessarily control. True pleasure, when you're truly present to it, it brings you to satisfaction, and then you're done. And that extra glass of wine, or that extra plate of food, or that extra clothes you just have to get, that actually is taking you into dis-ease, or into debt, or into other experiences that aren't pleasure, isn't pleasure anymore. Instead, it's this contorted, disruptive version of pleasure. One of the understandings I've come to have about pleasure is that the reason it has been given such a bad rap, it's because it is our most primal pull. Out of everything in life, pleasure pulls us the most, and of that, sexual pleasure. And if the powers that be can have us feel at war with our most primal pull, then we're confused. We're out of our power. You know, a woman, a man who walks to the beat of their own sexual drum, is empowered in a way that won't necessarily go to war, won't necessarily sign their life away in a meaningless way, because they're in touch with themselves as their own source of power and pleasure. So here we need to define pleasure not just as that thing that's out there that someone does to you, but as you showing up to have the experience. So being present, you're breathing, you're feeling, you're sensing, you're experiencing, you're choosing to look on the bright side of things. Quote from one of my teachers, the pursuit of pleasure requires a willingness to reach for the good, no matter what the circumstances. Pleasure, then, we see as responsibility, as accountability, as not getting caught in, oh, poor me, victim, all these bad things, I can't be happy in my relationship. But looking for the good, looking to create the good, being the source of the good. So we look to have it in our relationship with ourselves, constantly. So your primary relationship is full of pleasure, so that you are overflowing from it, and then you come to relationship full, already with a banquet as your life, not a beggar's bowl, hungry for someone to complete you and tell you that you're good and worthy, because you've worked that out. And then ideally, they're coming from the same place. Now you've got these two totalities meeting and merging and overflowing and giving each other, each from their banquets. And part of that banquet is sex. About time we talk about that, Valentine's Day. So, I mean, what distinguishes, you know, romantic Valentine's relationship from any other relationship, of course, is that there's a sexual component. You know, we have many friends in our lives, but there's only a certain amount of people that we're going to be lovers with, we're going to have a sexual relationship with. And that's, of course, why it's really important that we're in touch with our own animal and at peace with our own desires. Because your animal, I say that in a positive light. Your body's an animal, like it's a good thing. Some of you are like, Jenna, that's not a good thing. My body's an animal. You know, animals desire all kinds of things, and they've got animal appetites. That's not very good. And, you know, why is that not very good? And one thing I've noticed in my teachings in weight loss is when a woman is not allowed to really own her sexual appetite, it will morph into excessive appetite for food. And you know, I'm sure the same applies with men. So we say, well, why? How can we want to be sexy, and at the same time feel a lot of shame around sex. So I just want to put that out there. Who feels like, oh, yeah, I would love to be sexy. I'd love to feel sexy. Be brave. Put up your hands. Excellent. All right. Basically everyone. We all want that. And of course we do, because you're sexy, you get the sexual attention, you get the sexual pleasure. Your animal wants it. Whether your mind was like, don't raise your hand, animal's like, yes, yes. Okay, so your animal wants to be sexy, but there's a lot of stigma around a sexy person. So just wanted to bring that contrast to the surface. So what do we think of sexy person, sexy woman, sexy guy? What's the stigma that we associate with that? Easy. Loose. Needy. Shallow. So the stigma, we're looking for the stigma. Unprofessional. Dumb. Ouch. Bimbo. Slut. Out of control. Okay, so these judgments come up when we see a sexy person. We don't even know them, anything about them. We just see a sexy person in the corner of our eyes, you know, bimbo. Right? And then if we have this going on in our judgments of others, we have it going on in our judgments of ourselves. So when your sexy arises, it's terrifying. Those desires aren't safe. And now your partner senses that you're not even safe with your own sexy and your own desires. How the hell are you going to be safe with theirs? They feel your little bubble of shame around yours. They'll put their bubble around theirs. And now you're having great conversations over dinner, and the minds are having an awesome time, and maybe we're going to therapy, and we're talking about everything. Isn't that great? But the animals are there with their shame buckets, jackets, and denied of pleasure, told it's disruptive. And that's why we have such a high divorce rate. That's why we have such painful experiences with our relationships, because that very primal force of 50% of us, the animal part, has a huge stigma on it. So how do we heal that? How do we change that stigma? The expression I want to introduce you to is erotic innocence. Erotic innocence. Erotic innocence. My definition here. Total and complete aliveness, that which animates life, that which is instinctively drawn towards the sensual, the sexual, the pleasurable. Experienced from a place of non-duality, meaning before right or wrong has even entered the picture. That's our erotic innocence. We're not taught this. We're not taught that from the time we're born, we're seeking it, we're looking for it, we're playing for it. One of my friends told me that she saw a child, a little boy. She changed his nappy. It was her friend's son. And while the child was having this nappy change, she's there giggling. She brings the arms down like this. Giggle, giggle, giggle. And he points at his genitals in just total delight while he's having his nappy change. It's erotic innocence. Pure, childlike, not trying to hurt anyone, not trying to have power over, not trying to manipulate, nothing destructive, pure innocence. So as we speak about this, you might feel that part of you stirring. Your animal and her erotic innocence or his erotic innocence going, yeah, I'd like some space on the stage. And now imagine if you realize that your erotic innocence had been oppressed since childhood. You know, if someone's been oppressed, it's nice to go out of your way to help them a little bit because they haven't had the advantages that you've had. So you might start to have that relationship towards this part of you, realizing it hasn't had much space in your life, it hasn't had much room to grow, it hasn't had much support, and to find environments that will nurture it, to find books that will help you understand it more, to find workshops, to find friends who are safe with their erotic innocence so you can be safe with yours. And then you can do the same for your partner because they may have a big cramp around theirs. So you can help them feel at peace with their erotic innocence as they do the same for you. And then you're helping each other along the way. What's last? What I call this is making sexy safe. Making your sexy safe, making your partner sexy safe. Not as your only pleasure, but amongst your life of pleasures. This is only one flavor. Sexuality, sensuality. There are so many ways to have pleasure. Pleasure with music, pleasure with dance, pleasure with tickling, pleasure with cuddling, pleasure with experiencing the senses through art. It's pleasure through meditation, pleasure through yoga. And when you bring that to your relationship and say, let's make pleasure a priority, let's make space for this, let's have the understanding that pleasure is a necessary ingredient to keep the animal parts happy. And if they're happy, they're happy within themselves. If that primary relationship is happy, well, huge head start. And then if they're happy with each other, then you can just imagine the two happy animals are more than happy to let the minds go, have a great life, have their satisfaction. And they only act like brats when they're being neglected. And if you're not happy with your body, if you're feeling, oh, I need to lose weight, or some story that you have, your body's not good or right, it's just a cry for help. It's just a cry for attention. She is good. He is good. He may be the forgotten one, the neglected one up until now in your primary relationship. But the great thing about your body, when I say they're animals, they really are like puppies, I've heard in that way, dogs. That even if you're mean to them yesterday, tomorrow they forget and they're like, oh, we're best friends. So you're going to find that with your body. It's a really great perk, actually, of having an animal as your body, is that as soon as you turn the corner and start saying, I'm going to love you now, I'm going to invest in this primary relationship, I'm going to have your priorities of sleep and movement and sex and water and just those few basics. There were, what, half a dozen, 7 or 8. I'm going to make you, what's important to you, a priority equally as what's important to me, conquering the world. And then there's an incredible team dynamic within you and yourself that you can bring to your own relationship. Now, you may be thinking, well, Jenna, that's great for you. And what about me, my life, and my circumstances? So the tool I want to give you to just come back to is this idea that you are creating your life. By choosing the discipline to go for pleasure, you're defining that. The cultural toe is towards suffering. Have you noticed? Punishment. There's a lot more research about pain and suffering and problems than there is about innovation and what is pleasure and feeling good. So taking a stand in that sway of the river towards suffering and saying, no, I commit to pleasure. Even if the circumstances give me no good reason to be happy right now, give me no good reason to look for what's positive, I'm going to. I'm going to in my own life. I'm going to look for it in my partner, even when they're being a crabby ass today. I'm going to find a way to find have this be funny, have this be entertaining in the narrative of our lives. And that's what being accountable is. You're creating the account of your own life. You're writing the account. You're the author as well as the main character living it out. It's a beautiful paradox to imagine. So accountability, you are creating your life. And that's one of my favorite expressions when I'm feeling like, oh, things aren't how I want them to be, is, oh yeah, I'm creating this. Reminder. Okay, how can I create it differently? And a great question to ask yourself is, what would be the most entertaining next step for the main character to take in the direction of the desired outcome? That can be the author part of you. What would be the most entertaining next step? And think of this right now. In your lives, whether you're here single and you're working on your primary relationship, which is a great time to learn about pleasure, learn about what turns you on, learn about how to conduct pleasure in your body, because actually no one can do that for you. It's an inside job to be able to channel pleasure, experience it, feel it, not push it away or damp it down. So when you're single, you have the time to do that. It's a great time to do that. And if you are single, I want to really legitimize your desire for bonding. Now, animals like to bond. We are gregarious creatures. We sleep better when we have a partner. Our systems sync up. We feel better partnered. So if you're single, realizing that, make time to cuddle with your friends, your platonic friends. Make time to, I used to do a dance called contact improvisation, where it was a very safe context, but there would be safe touch involved. Or get massages, or be in community, be connected. Don't be isolated if you're single, because that's punishing your body even more. And if you're in a partner, then also bring that commitment that you have to creating your life now to creating this partnership. How can you create it together? Oh, yeah, sorry. So the question is, whether you're single or in partner, what would be the most entertaining next move for your main character to take in the direction towards your dreams, your desired outcome? So coming back to my desired outcome, and when I was there in Israel, on that bus, it was a bus trip actually, and my friend saying to me, hey, you know, Jenna, you think love's limitation. Yeah, I was like, damn right I do. Love's going to be bars around my cage. And he said, no, Jenna, you're missing the point. Love, by its very definition, is the absence of limitation itself. Love, by its definition, is the absence of limitation. Something in the way he said it went deeply into me, and I realized, what would be love that would box me in? What would be love that wouldn't allow me to be free? That's the level of love I want you to bring to your primary relationship. Our body and mind are both free to be who they are, to bring their gifts without the other adding shame or judgment, and for you to be free in your lives to find the love that is true for you, where you get to love another animal and a mind, be loved by their mind and their animal, and two of you can have a happy little foursome. So thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure to deliver this information, and we actually have Q&A time right now. So if you would like to ask a question. Great. So there's a mic up here.
Okay, I would like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. So we are with our speaker tonight is Jenna LaFlamme. We're going to turn it over for questions and answers for about 15 minutes. So please Do ask your question to the mic.
Jenna,
yeah.
How did you know that Michael was the one?
How did I know Michael was the one? Well, we met on a dance floor, and I had looked into what are the qualities that I wanted in my mate, and a friend of mine had given me an exercise where you make four columns, and there's must have. There's preferably not, and there's no way. And so I had my list, and his philosophy was when you're just dating and you're just, you know, wanting to be out there and having a good time, you're not necessarily like on a mission to meet the one. It doesn't matter if they've got even a few no ways on there, as long as you're having, you know, as long as it's okay. But the more you move towards a serious relationship, the more you want it to be the must-haves. And so I had, story goes that it was just the week after I had been in Israel and had this awakening where I realized that my idea of love confining me was my idea. It was my creation. That was my own limitation. That was projecting it on love to blame love for limiting me. Ha ha, clever. So I realized, oh, love is freedom, of course. And so I came back to New York, but I wasn't in a particular rush to manifest love. I knew I wanted it one day, and I was pretty busy building my business and doing my thing. And it was actually a good place to be in, where I wasn't feeling that need. I was just feeling like I'm filling my cup, and I'm being me, and love will come in its time. And then someone had given Michael a tip-off that I was single and available. So we met a Burning Man, and he came to New York and rang me up and asked me out on a date. And I was very cavalier and like, oh, sure, you can tag along with me. And ego, oh, my gosh. And so we went dancing, and it was lovely. And then he said, would you like to have tea afterwards? And I thought that was very healthy. And I'm a health coach, so that's a good thing. So we actually went to my wellness center and had tea and talked and really, what we did was an act of transparency, both of us, where we said, we want to be seen. And without, you know, if someone's like, hey, let me tell you about me, and it's just all about them. It wasn't like that. It was this layer upon layer of revealing our truths and being really courageous and coming from a place of not having shame, or where we had shame, saying, this is where I have shame about who I am, but I'm going to show you anyway. So we got really naked with our desires, with our fears, with our Achilles heels, and somehow the maps matched up, and we both just went, oh, you're the one. So I don't know if that's the map for everyone, but for us there was a clear recognition that our maps of reality, our values, our desires, our dreams, our aesthetic in life really matched up. And then... So then I was like, oh, my mind is in love with his mind. Oh, no, how are the animals going to get along? So then we found out. And the animals got along very well. And then I was like, okay, I can marry this man. So that's the story. It was a two-part interview, actually. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the lovely conversation tonight. I wanted to know, precisely because you just mentioned the two-part interview, some of the other euphemisms we use around this topic, we also construct love, pleasure, and a number of these things as sort of not only private, but something that everyone else has to avoid getting into the issue of. And I'm wondering how you relate to that social convention of ours.
Can you make the question
makes
more
it hard to find someone else.
Say the question in a different way, so I get it more.
Okay. So we've got a lot of expectations about privacy, about relationships. And those obviously make a lot of sense because people can easily get hurt. But we drive it to such a point, I fear, that it's not socially acceptable to see if someone wants to open up, to see if someone wants to have that sort of conversation you had with Michael. And I'm wondering what your advice is, either on seeking if someone is ready to go to that point or to bring up that approach in a way that people are more willing to try it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, I get the question. So I think that firstly begins with your primary relationship. And if you, within yourself, can know that talking about my feelings, talking about my desire for intimacy, my desire for true love, my desire for the minds to get along and the animals, if you're comfortable within that conversation within yourself, you're going to feel safe. And the other person will pick up on that. Even if they feel unsafe, they can sort of borrow your safety a little bit. It's as if you can throw out a picnic blanket and say, it's okay. It's safe for us to talk about love and how we feel. And if you keep connected in your body in a sense that your breath is calm and you're actually giving the experience of this really is safe, then I think they will, they'll be invited. Be a leader is what I would say. You can practice with your friends so that when it's with a romantic interest, you already have some practice in talking about those topics. Great question. Thank you. Microphone.
Yes. When you discover, and I love this idea that love is actually not a limitation, but it's actually freedom.
Can you speak louder? Can you start the question again?
Yes. I love the idea that you, not the idea, but what you share with us, that love is actually a liberation and it's not a limitation. It doesn't limit us. So it's freedom, actually, when you love. But do you think that the limitation comes because of this necessary commitment or thinking about the long term? Is this sort of a limitation for love? The long term and the commitment and all these back thoughts. Mm-hmm. And to what extent living in the presence and it now, how this relates to all the commitment and the long term.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that if I understand the question, how do you feel free and not limited when you've made a commitment? And how can freedom and lack of limitation go with, I promised, and I'll be there. And it's this idea of relationship, does there need to be compromise in relationship? And I think we were all raised with the understanding that, yes, of course there has to be compromise in relationship. But I've heard it otherwise said that if you can come from a perspective of collaboration, where you're not competing with each other, but instead of being you against each other when there's a misunderstanding or a point of conflict for where there might need to be a compromise, it can be you two in collaboration in face of the misunderstanding, then you can collaborate on an answer and not be compromised. So in terms of a lifelong commitment, that's being standing together with your lifelong commitment and saying, oh, here's a threat to our lifelong commitment, or here's a bump in the road. How can we collaboratively, with our freedom, with our authorship of our life, create what we want and keep our commitment while feeling free? I think it'll be case by case. Yeah.
I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on monogamy.
Great. While I'm answering that, I'm actually going to pass around a clipboard here. For anyone who would like to stay in my world, I have a couple of things on offer here. I have a video series that's called The Secrets of Pleasurable Weight Loss, and you can put down your name and email. Yeah. And I know a lot of my tribe are already here, so you're already on here. You don't need to double up. And also there's an option there if you would like to have a strategy session with me, 20 minutes to talk about what's going on with you, whether it be with weight loss or relationships. I'm offering that as a gift to the audience tonight, complimentary, so you can put a tick on here and we'll follow up with that. Okay, so what do I think of monogamy? In terms of the animals, yeah. So my understanding is that we grew up as, before we were Homo sapiens, we were hominids, and we've gone from being monkeys to cavemen to what we are today. And there was a time in our evolution when we roamed the savannas of Africa in a band of about 12 or 13. And at that time, belonging to the tribe was everything. Because if you were rejected, you died. You're gone. So you need to belong. So my understanding is at that time that there would have been more sexual belonging. That would have been part of the tribe. If you're with 13 people forever, eventually you're going to explore different possibilities. And I think that monogamy would be pretty unlikely then. And my understanding is that the concept of monogamy started to enter human development when we became an agrarian society. When we moved from being hunter-gatherers to actually farming and owning land and fences. And, you know, this is my land, this is my chicken, my cow, my woman. And that monogamy is actually a later development that as we've socialized, as we've as we've moved from being less animalistic and living just in the land to being more engineering and of the mind, that monogamy has developed. So I think now we find ourselves in a situation where that's that toggle between the mind and the aesthetic of the mind and the primal hunger of the body, which isn't politically correct. I mean, I was a vegetarian for many years, and it was very political, and I think it's very correct to be a vegetarian, but my animal doesn't. She thinks it's a terrible idea, I discovered after 7 years. Doesn't mean I need to eat a lot of meat. It can just be a homeopathic amount, just the smallest amount that works for my animal. And so similarly, I think this there's a definite pull and a conflict. And for some people, there's a very comfortable ability to embrace monogamy as how they want to be. And for other people, it's conflicted and doesn't feel right at all. And, it's difficult for those people because our society is very, puts a moralistic stance on it that, you know, monogamy is the good way and the others are kind of lesser than. So I think definitely different people will have different desires there.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for only one more question. Is there another? Okay.
Many years ago, I saw a film, a Swedish film, called Scenes from a Marriage. And it showed how we change as the decades go by. I think you're only talking about the initial decade here. The transitions depend so much on not just your two animals. There's little animals that come into your life.
Yes, little animals come in. Yeah. You have babies. And the animals breed.
And they have their own desires, and you have to deal
with
them. And then the big animal may get jealous of the little animal, and so on.
It's complicated.
And times change, and how do you deal with change over the decades?
I think I need another question. being in my early 30s, I only have the authority to really speak to the decades I've been through, and I haven't had children. What is it specifically for you now that you want so I could help you?
Well, you're saying all the positive things, and I've been through all the great things.
Yes.
The pleasurable things, and sex was the most important thing, and came first in your life. And then as you mature...
Oh, sorry, you need the microphone again.
As you mature, other things, you know, have a important role in your life, and you have to be able to understand that and go through shallow periods and live through them, and you have problems, and your children have problems. And it's not just the initial beginning.
and the great pleasures you're seeking here, but it's the long run that really counts for a good life.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that was a statement rather than a question, so I really appreciate the...
Well, why don't you give us a wrap-up here, just a short closing statement to send us off to Valentine's Day.
Okay. My parting words are that pleasure is the key. Whenever you have a problem, it's often going to, you're often going to be told that the problem is too much pleasure, too much indulgence in this, too much indulgence in that. But actually what's happened is that your vista of pleasure has become so narrow and contracted and clumped that you've put all the pleasure into the food, for example, or you've put all the pleasure into the sex, and it's imbalanced. So what you were saying about it spreading out, you know, sometimes it will be the sexual pleasure that's certainly the highlight of that day, but another day it may be the pleasure of rocking the baby in your arms and how that animal came from yours. What we want to do is start to become connoisseurs of pleasure, to understand all the gradations from the very physical to the more subtle to the emotional, also the mental, and to welcome them, and to realize that pleasure is an intelligent guiding force. It's a compass. If we follow pleasure, true pleasure, not addiction dressed up as counterfeit pleasure, if we follow true pleasure, we make it across the breadth of our lives, not only our own, but in relationship, in community, and we stay with that understanding that we're creating this, we're authoring this, then even in the moments of pain, of course there will be. We're not coming from a deluded idea, oh, it's all pleasure, no pain, but in that moment of pain and suffering and heartbreak, how can you choose to write the story that this is in service of the greater pleasure of the ups and downs of life? Pleasure problem is never too much. It's always not enough. And I invite you to embrace the discipline of seeking it, knowing it as a connoisseur, as an art, as a spiritual path, and to yourselves being pleasure activists, pleasure revolutionaries who teach these values to others. The rising boat, so what they say, the rising tide floats all boats. So as you rise into the pleasure of your life, you will notice there are no negative consequences on others, only inspiration, and that with your rise, so too will come theirs. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank our speaker tonight, Janelle LaFlamme. Our program is The Key to Finding and Keeping Love. I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club tonight, our audience listening at home. And with that, I would like to conclude this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion. Thanks to Jenna, and if you...